Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barlingham Barrett on Crime. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'm joined by my good friend, veteran trial lawyer Manny Barling. Manny, hello.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing great. I do have a story for you, which I know will probably rankle at least one of our guests. I was talking to a good friend of mine yesterday. I'll leave his name out to protect the innocent or guilty, but he is a friend of Ted Nugent. And apparently he was talking to Ted earlier yesterday, and Ted is completely unrepentant over the recent furore he's caused, and to excuse the pun, is sticking by his guns.
Oh, good for him. I love it. I like a man that sticks by his guns.
Also joining us today is LA-based attorney and always insightful analyst, Peter Haven. Peter, good to have you on the program again.
Oh, it's great to be here, and I want to wish everyone a very happy Seis de Mayo.
Oh, yeah. Cinco de Mayo. Oh, no, Set de Mayo, isn't it now?
I officially wished everyone a happy May 6th, because I'm a day late.
You know, Simon lived in San Diego, and he misses Cinco de Mayo. And our other guest, believe it or not, today is the pride of Claremont McKenna, who's come back to torture us all with his somewhat interesting leanings. John Perry, our favorite person to represent the views of law enforcement. But are they really the views of law enforcement? John, welcome.
I can't speak for law enforcement, Manny. I tend to think outside the box. I want to thank you for that kind intro. And seldom have I heard words of praise so sincerely articulated and well-deserved.
Uh-oh, I'm going to have to buy lunch, guys.
Yeah, I mean, what did you bribe him with?
I don't know. I mean, I got to go check. Maybe I gave him money. I don't know. Did I overpay
Manny,
you,
let me reciprocate the compliment. I feel privileged to be part of this August panel today. And since I've been listening to you guys, I've been racking my mind who you're reminiscent of. And I thought of the Dorothy Parker Roundtable, which
that's a
one of its members, Humphrey Bogart, referred to as the summit.
It's a wonderful, wonderful, thing. I would presume I will be Alexander, what's his, Saul kind of said his name, the critic who started movie and play critics, who was the chairman of the group, a brilliant man, and the subject of the movie Laura, if you've ever seen it.
And Simon, that'll be the last compliment I pay you today.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
Well, you know, Simon, I hate it, but we're going to have to get serious because we have important issues in America to deal with. But first, before we jump in, we don't have a lot to say about Trayvon Martin. We'd hope today to discuss that and the sentencing of Marissa Alexander in Florida for the similar, you know, stand your ground crime, but apparently there's so much public outcry in Florida, they're afraid to sentence her, so they put it off for weeks. I don't think they can put it off till the end of the Trayvon Martin case, but I think they're going to try. And Peter, have you ever had cases like this where suddenly the court, the DA, or even civil participants become so concerned with, you know, what's going on in the news and on national television that you start to putting the cases off? Have you ever had that experience?
Yeah, I have had that experience, and it can be frustrating. But for whatever reason, the judges have enough things to do every day. And if they decide that, that's something they want to put on the back burner or whoever makes that decision, it's very easy to put that stuff on the back burner and just let it sit for a while. And it seems to me that that's exactly what's going on.
Yeah, me too. You have any thoughts about that, John, when you were in that? Were you frustrated when you made an arrest and it became very public and suddenly the press started influencing the case?
No, Manny. I never shied away from publicity. And I always thought as long as the DA was permitted to present their side of it. That's just the way the law works.
Well, it kind of bothers me because I think when a case gets delayed because of, quote, public interest, isn't that justice denied?
Well, in this case, I agree with you because she's in jail.
Right.
So they don't care. They can put it off forever as long as she's rotting in jail, right? These guys go home to their families, and they're not deeply concerned about someone else spending time in jail.
Right, but I mean, what seriously concerns me about the Marissa case is the fact that she didn't kill anyone, she didn't injure anyone. I mean, sure, she discharged a firearm in the house, but well, I've met a few people that have done that over the years.
Haven't we all?
Right. I mean, does she deserve 20 years in behind bars?
No, I think in some instances and in some jurisdictions, capping a round off in your house might be considered a, you know, custom. I mean, you know, it happens. I had an instance in the case of Tupac Shakur, who was killed. One of my friends was the next-door neighbor, and the police asked them to go, the wife, who's very tiny, to go through the doggy door because they wanted to look at the house but didn't have time to get a warrant. And when she went in, the first comment she made to me was how many bullet holes there were in the ceilings and throughout the house where he'd been just shooting his gun. So does that make that illegal? I don't know.
Well, there was a rather silly case. It was a couple of years ago. A guy got arrested. He did this on his own property. He was incredibly annoyed at his car. It kept breaking down. It was a lemon. So he got his rather large firearm out and blasted it a few times.
Was he British?
No, he wasn't. Brits don't tend to carry a lot of weaponry around.
Actually, what I meant to say was the car British.
I can't remember the brand, and I can't remember the details, but yeah, it was just one of those cases where you went, huh?
Oh, I've seen guys get frustrated and whack their car with a tire iron. It actually is very disturbing because, you know, it's hard to go after them and fix it.
Okay.
Okay, we're gonna let's move on to the more interesting one. And for our viewers who have not had this opportunity, there's a case in White Plains, New York, involving a gentleman named Kenneth Chamberlain that's been in and out of CNN for. And is basically about 5 months ago, this elderly African-American gentleman, about 68 years old, had his medical aid device go off and notified 911, who called the police to arrive there. He apparently felt better or whatever happened, and he notified them that he didn't need any help. Well, of course, the police came up, knocked on the door, and it's now about 2 or 3 a.m., and he really didn't want to let him in because I think it's common in the African-American community to be concerned about police knocking your door that time of day. So it ensued about an hour argument of them demanding to come in and him saying, no, I feel fine, I don't need you, go away. And it went on, and finally the medical dispatcher said to the police, he's in no danger, leave him alone. But they kept going and going. And by the way, this was caught on videotape because apparently taser guns in White Plains have a video connection on it, a mini cam, and it recorded all of this, including him being shot.
Well, also, it was recorded through the internal CCTV coverage of
right.
The apartment block.
So they had lots of video, and the argument went on, and finally the police broke the door down. They claimed he had a knife in his hand, and they shot him. And, of course, the bullet went through his arm and through his lungs, and he died shortly thereafter.
Well, no. I disagree here.
Okay, well, if you have better facts, go for it.
Okay. Police break down the door. and he's still being grumpy. So they hit him with a taser. Now, it's not clear if, you know, both cords connected or what. And anyway, the taser didn't seem to fix the problem. So then they pull out a shotgun and blast him with a beanbag round. Apparently, that didn't fix the problem. So then they pull out a 40 cal handgun and blast the guy. I mean, excuse me, six cops, a 68-year-old man. I find it hard to believe that six young, obviously very fit, and one would hope well-trained men could not subdue a 68-year-old guy with a heart problem.
And, guys, I'm a 68-year-old man, and I can tell you a senior citizen woman with a purse would probably take me down in two rounds if it went that long. And I find that amazing, too.
Right.
So, Peter, anyone have any comment about that?
Well, Manny, no. Oh, go ahead, Peter.
Wait, no, you go ahead, John. You have experience with this kind of stuff. You go ahead.
Well, before I address the issue, I had a question for you, Simon. I was viewing your promo picture for the show, and I was really impressed by the fact that you could fit into your high school yearbook suit. And I was wondering, is the material polyester, rayon, or a seersucker?
Okay, all right. John, you now officially owe me lunch.
Well, as long as we go to a restaurant where you look up at the menu instead of down.
Okay, let's get back to
okay,
what
I'm
we were
at,
talking
I'm at about. Okay, I'm I don't like to question the actions of officers in the field, but I'll speak generally how I like to work, which probably didn't fit in policy a lot of times. But six people, way too much. I would have told the other four, me and my partner got it, you can leave. I would have tried to get the neighbors or any relatives there, talk to the guy, try to defuse the situation, not escalate it. Talk to him about something you have in common, maybe ask him what kind of beer he drinks. Does he want a cigarette? Are the Lakers on? How do you think, you know, are the Knicks, how are they going to do in the playoffs? And let him know you're there just to check on his welfare, not to escalate the situation. And
right.
To me, to break down the door, you got to have some kind of exigent circumstances. I don't know what they're claiming they were, but to me, if you can't talk to them and reach them, get somebody there who can, even if it's on the phone. There's no reason to rush in my eyes.
Right. And
why that was done, I have no idea. But generally speaking, any time you have more than two officers at a location, problems are going to arise.
Yeah, and to make matters worse,
people are going to act on their own volition, and you know they don't want to stay there, so they're going to want to wrap it up and probably be a little overzealous.
Right, but to make matters worse, apparently, and obviously I have to guess here, but based on the audio recordings, there was at least one other officer involved who was at the back of the apartment trying to, quote, distract this gentleman, mm-hmm. while the door was going to be busted.
Well, I would have tried to distract him by taking his mind off
right,
the situation.
Well,
I mean,
let me
tell you how many times
I've told somebody,
hey, go get a dozen donuts or Taco Bell or McDonald's ice cream. Let's diffuse this and make sure he's okay, because that's why you're there.
Okay. Well, the distraction method was to shout at Kenneth Chamberlain and use the N-word at him.
Oh, that, I know that's alleged. There's a couple of rules I always followed real quick. Never call someone you think crazy is crazy, because they've been called that all their life and they get upset. And don't argue with them. Never disagree with them. And that doesn't appear that it was done, but I don't know these guys' experience, but it's a tragedy, and everybody feels bad he was shot, and I feel bad for the officers, too. I'm sure they didn't go there with that intent. They just went to check on his welfare, and things escalated. I feel bad for everybody.
You know, John, I'm really glad to hear you say some of these things, because as you read the account of this, the impression that you get is, wow, how could this have gotten so out of hand? And I'm glad to hear you say, and I agree with you. I think that police officers, generally speaking, don't want to get into an altercation here. They want to think that this is a non-issue, and they want to get out of there and go home and write up their paperwork. At least that's what
no
I would
imagine.
No one
even wants to write paperwork. Look at what they have now. They could have just made sure he was okay and left, no paperwork.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was a MedAlert audio recording, and there was a series of MedAlert attempts to talk to the police, and at least two different people wanted to make contact with Mr. Chamberlain, his son, and I believe his sister.
And I think that's how it should have been handled.
Yeah, and that struck me as, why wouldn't, you know, when I was listening to those audio tapes, it struck me as, well, why wouldn't you want to do that? I mean,
the guy's not a criminal. You just want to make sure he's not a danger to himself, unless they didn't know if somebody else was in there. That raises the ante. From what I've heard, they didn't think that. But if another person's involved, then you might have a different perspective.
Hardly know what to think of it, except that it does appear to have been incredibly mishandled. And having had an extensive investigation, subject to a 23-member grand jury panel that concluded the shooting was justified, all you can think is that these officers responded, and they just didn't like Mr. Chamberlain's attitude. And they probably would have done something else. This is just extrapolating from the facts that we seem to know. If they had gotten some sort of better reaction for some reason, they decided to escalate the issue, and then things obviously spun out of control. But it just seems, that it should have been handled much, much differently, especially when you have as many police officers there as you did.
Way too many. Two would have sufficed.
Well, let me add something in there. I don't agree with some of that concept, and I'm going to throw in the mix here, come back to Indiana. The case we're talking about, Indiana, ruled essentially that police have the right to enter a home for any reason or no reason at all, and a homeowner can't do anything to block the entry. Now, the court decision, I think, is just fatally flawed, and it's a terrible one, but it addresses a basic issue. The differentiation between a domestic dispute and police responding to that and a different type of call. And in this case, it was a MedAlert. In the case of the one in Indiana, it's a domestic case. There's some basis for saying that if you get a call on 911 or something and a wife is claiming to be abused, or there's some domestic dispute going on, and the police show up and the wife goes, oh, no, nothing's wrong. I think there's a little more basis for the police to be concerned about the consequences of leaving a wife in that position where she could be murdered or injured and they could be subsequently criticized. This, to me, is substantially different where we're talking about a medical issue. And, of course, one of the arguments I heard is, he could have died if we didn't respond. Well, if you're going to go in and shoot him and with a taser, beanbag him, and then shoot him with a gun, I don't think that that's the best solution to a medical problem, and I'm sure you guys don't. So it comes back to that fundamental thing in American culture, which is a home is a man's castle, which we all know goes from English common law carried over to the United States, and the concept that every person has a right to privacy in their own home without a warrant. So right now, the question is, should there have been a warrant? What was their justification? What was the probable cause for entering other than they didn't like his attitude?
Well, Manny, they couldn't have gotten a warrant because there was no crime alleged.
That's the point, and there was no crime found to be committed even after his arrest, or excuse me, his death. So at the end of the day, that really raises questions of what it's all about.
A crime.
Yeah.
You know, the concept of getting a warrant is an interesting one. You know, police may realize that they need to get a warrant, and if they have a proper exigent circumstance, they can then, you know, exercise their discretion to engage in a further search or investigation. If cops make the decision that they don't care about getting a good arrest on this thing, they just want to kick the door down, and I'm just hypothecating here, speculating, then in theory they don't have to worry about getting a warrant or having exigent circumstances because they're not going to try to arrest this person. They just want to kick the door down and find out what's going on. And, you know, there's some indication that that may have happened here, that they thought, what the heck, we'll kick the door down, we'll see what's going on in there, and you know, we'll bootstrap it from there.
They were going on an expedition like they thought he was part of the Medellin cartel.
Well, I'm not playing fishing expedition. It just seems to me they got there.
To look around. I don't think so.
Well, something set them off to kick down the door, and I'm just trying to figure out emotional. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Okay. And they let their emotion
to get caught up in the moment.
Run away with their logic.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go back to the Indiana case just for a second. It went to an appeals court, and I found the ruling by the appeals judges to be fascinating. That there's one line in particular that just leapt out and strangled me. All right, try this on for illogic. We hold that there is no right to reasonably resist unlawful entry by police officers.
Well, you know, in some states, that could get them in a lot of trouble.
I mean, doesn't it, Manny, bother you?
Well, no, believe it or not, that's one that doesn't bother me as much as it bothers you, because once they're in the house, you know, you've got a different legal situation, and you probably have to deal with it in a different legal manner, which is one of the things that they point out to consume for damage and do a million other things. You can quash whatever they get from the search. I mean, you know, there's lots of different choices, so I think once they're in the house, I think it gets increasingly more difficult for a citizen to go, you know, you're wrongfully in my house, I think I'm going to fire a few shots at you, which is, of course, the extreme. But what that ruling ignores is the heat of the moment and what an American will do when someone invades their home, irrespective of a uniform or no uniform. Do you agree with that, Peter?
Yeah, absolutely. The heat of the moment, John talked about emotion. I mean, I was really saying the same thing. I just wasn't saying it very well. You know, what happens is these officers get caught up in the moment, and also they have to make gut calls. They have to, you know, rely on their instincts, and they make decisions. And when the court is writing that statement, it's essentially saying, you know, we're going to review after the fact whether or not there was sufficient exigency, whether or not there was sufficient probable cause. But we don't want citizens making that determination. And, you know, that in and of itself doesn't really surprise me by itself. What's surprising is what we're supposed to do with all of this, because I don't think that in the heat of the moment people are really going to turn to this court decision and say, wait a minute, what do I do? If people feel you know, what the court is really saying, that if officers are in there and they look like they're trying to do their job, you know, you don't have any right to stop them, whether they have the right to be there or not. The more interesting situation is what happens if people feel like their lives are in danger or You know, they really feel like an officer is about to attack them or something. I don't know how this really translates into the moment of impact when people are caught up in the heat of the moment and they're trying to, you know, do whatever it is they're going to do when all heck breaks loose, which is typically what happens in these situations.
Yeah, basically they're asking American citizens to go, stop, I'll just let the courts take care of this, particularly at a time in our society where so many Americans have lost faith in our court system, which seems to be something they're ignoring.
You know, the question is, I mean, one of the questions is, what happens if you're a, I guess what happens is if you're a citizen and an officer is in there and you feel that he shouldn't be and you confront him or get in an argument with him or commit a battery or do whatever you do, you don't have any kind of defense to being criminally prosecuted for doing that. And I guess that's how the case arose. Somebody was prosecuted for getting into punching an officer, and he didn't have a legal defense that said he can punch an officer if the officer is in his home. I mean, that's one way of looking at the opinion. Otherwise, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I don't know how else to interpret the way this case arose in this context, and I don't know what's going to happen to it after this, if it's going to go up. I don't think this is going to get to the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you, Manny?
Oh, I think it's quite possible, and one of the reasons is there's a serious Fourth Amendment issue, and when you read the case, you may have noticed that some of the justices commented that if it had been restrained to strictly a situation involving domestic disputes, they might have had a completely different position and joined the majority, but because it was such a broad statement, they weren't willing to take that position. And therein lies the problem in my mind with this decision, is if it were focused literally on that issue, I probably wouldn't have the feelings I have about it, but it isn't. It's just too broad a stroke.
Yeah. Well, they're clearly casting a clear line on what is a blurry situation, and they're saying cops can basically go into your home whenever you want and you don't have legal recourse to do anything about it. I don't know what's going to happen if they encounter a situation where somebody really tries to defend themselves and their life in that context. I suspect this law will be challenged again, this ruling.
Okay, I actually view it slightly differently. I think there's a bit of a difference between someone instigating a 911 call as opposed to someone doing nothing, or at least actively not doing anything, and a cop wanting to burst in. Two very different situations.
Well, I agree, and there's also the issue is if you have a neighbor who calls in, who says, I think there's something going wrong next door, going on next door, is that sufficient probable cause also for them to break in? Because then that raises questions about whether your neighbor can basically undermine your constitutional rights by taking some position in that regard, and that also bothers me. Go ahead.
That's actually a good point you stumbled onto, because that happens all the time. And generally speaking, if I got no response at the door and no evidence people were in there, I would tell the neighbor, if you feel strongly about it, you know these people better than I do, I'll stand by you and you break the window or kick in the door. But I don't have any independent knowledge of what's going on there. So you don't know the situation. A neighbor could be doing that just because they're upset with their neighbor. For all you know, there might be no one home. So really, until you arrive at the location, you don't prejudge it. Because whatever you do, it's your call. You're there. So use your best judgment.
And
Sean,
don't become
an instrument of someone else's beef with their neighbor.
Well, let's go a step farther than that. This is about initiation. And this is part of the discussion that's gone on in the Trayvon Martin case, is who initiated this and was the reason to initiate it, and what's the consequences of initiating some kind of event like this? And therein lies, to me, the biggest
Manny, before you move on to that, I'd like to ask you guys a question. Because this Indiana law, I'm a simple guy and I strive for clarity. To me, that ruling was overruling or overreaching and not specific enough, because in this particular case, there were a husband and wife arguing outside their residence. By the time the police arrived, they were inside. So I want to ask you guys, would you go in if the husband said at the door, oh, everything's fine, you can leave?
Well, again, I think your earlier statement about talking to the neighbors and determining whether they have a long history of fighting, he's got a history of violence, which, of course, a lot of this never
several of
really...
them, and they say, yeah, they were arguing out here, it's common. Just let me just
one of the things that, I think one of the things
if,
that
if you don't go in, Manny,
yeah,
and the woman's bleeding out, you think there's going to be a lawsuit?
No. Oh, yeah, you don't go in? That's why I separate domestic disputes from the others.
I agree. That's why I say it was just overreaching. Certain instances like that, there's exigent circumstances. But like you said, Simon, just to unlawfully enter someone's domicile, I mean, I thought that was settled 50 years ago with Mapp versus Ohio.
Yeah, I thought so, too. But what we have is a changing in environment and an increase in crime in our country that's causing judges to expand laws in a way that may not be in our best interest as a country. Yeah.
Well, it's some of them even creating new law, violating the Constitution.
Uh-huh.
What really concerns me about this law is, you know, there's kind of an assumption, this ruling, it's not a law, it's a decision by the Indianapolis Supreme Court. You know, it presumes that police officers are always going to basically be trying to do the right thing. I think far more often than not, that's what police officers do. I think that's what everyone does.
Right.
I think that generally speaking, if an officer is pushing his way into your home, he's doing so, or she is doing so, because they believe there's some legitimate interest in there or concern in there. They're trying to save lives. They're trying to protect people. They're trying to do the right thing. And the holding by the Indianapolis Supreme Court sort of embraces that assumption. It just assumes that that's why police officers are going to be in there. What really concerns me is, you know, you always have bad apples or bad motives. What happens when cops go in for completely improper reasons, completely inappropriate reasons, and the Indianapolis Supreme Court says, well, if they do that, the remedy is you've got a civil lawsuit, you've got other claims, complaints, that sort of thing. And that's really what the decision says. It basically says if they do this improperly and they are using it for some improper purpose, you can always sue them. And, you know, I really don't know how I feel about that. That will have to be tested in another situation down the line when somebody acts and they feel like the cops
don't
are completely in there inappropriately.
Don't you think a lot of law enforcement personnel are going to cite that case for fishing expeditions?
Absolutely.
I'm concerned that kind of power will lead to corruption, that people will say, well, now I can do whatever I want. And
well, I can go in there, and if I don't find anything, I'll just leave.
Again, or I could go in there for any reason I want.
Right.
The only remedy is, you know, the citizen will be able to file a complaint or file a lawsuit or do something like that. And that's troubling to me.
Well, let me throw some more spice on this one. And this is something that you and I are dealing with in Los Angeles, Peter. They are in the process of closing, 40-some departments? It's huge. And
yeah.
I have a case that's somewhat of a sensitive case, certainly they're sensitive to my client, in Simi Valley, which I've historically never appeared in. You know, one of those, you know the drill, someone close to you twists your arm and go, you've got to go save the day, and you stupidly agree to do it. And I did. So now I'm out there, and I find out when I go to file a motion that the judge who's heard the previous motions, whose knowledge of the previous motions would have an important impact on the case, has been reassigned because they're closing up the Simi Valley courthouse, which is legendary from the Rodney King case, and moving everything to Ventura. So they set two hearings, and one of them said to me, I have no idea where it's going to be. I don't even know who's going to hear the case. I mean, I just don't have a clue. And so I had to tell my client that right now I have no idea what's going to happen to her case, and nobody likes to tell their client that. So in the atmosphere of that going on in our country, how can the Supreme Court say to people, oh, you can rely on the court system, because most people don't feel they can? Do you disagree with that feeling right now, that it's hard to tell clients this?
No, I totally agree with that. I don't think we can count on the court system. I don't think we can count on the court systems. You know, that's one of the flaws. I don't think that people feel like they can count on the court systems is probably the more accurate way of saying it. And that's one of the flaws in the court's ruling. They're just assuming that this civil remedy, you know, the ability of citizens to go to court to file lawsuits and file complaints like that is going to be enough to deter them, at the same time that the judicial system is being curtailed due to budgetary cuts. And I assume it's the same thing in Indiana that it is here in California. I think that's a recipe for trouble.
Well, there's also this bigger issue, if you will. Lots of people don't have, you know, a whole schwack of money to throw around, you know, going to court. You know, it's not a cheap process. So, you know, how many folks are going to seek remedy through the legal system? The answer is a very small percentage. Because
Simon, throw in the concept of sovereign immunity, which, as you know, means a king can do wrong, no wrong, and the protections afforded to almost every form of government under our Constitution and interpretations of it. So here you got an uphill battle that you're also fighting sovereign immunity, and I'm sure that troubles you too, Peter.
Yeah, there are just a lot of problems with all of this. The real concern for me is what potential for abuse is going to arise here, and what we're really going to have to count on, I think, are the law enforcement agencies themselves to basically instruct their officers, police their own officers, and try to you know, make sure that they impose enough deterrence that officers don't take advantage of this kind of ruling. Because other than that, there's not going to be a very effective way to control it or curtail abuse, in my opinion.
And you say that in the light of the history of the LAPD and the recent oversight by the federal court because of their failure to handle a great many of these issues?
I say it in light of that, but I also just say it in light of human nature. I believe that for the most part, everybody is trying to do the best they can for all the right reasons, and they're trying to do good things, but there's always instances in every subsect of human existence. There's always instances where some individuals take advantage of it, misuse it, take liberties that they're not supposed to take. And this ruling seems to be a license to do that to a lot of law enforcement people who are, at the end of the day, still human beings. And that's the kind of stuff that concerns me. And it's not just law enforcement, it's across the board. But they have tremendous power, and this gives them, I think, arguably even greater power.
Yeah. Well, quick comment, then you have it, Simon. Isn't that a fact that's why various Supreme Courts have made those rulings in the past, is they're concerned with exactly what you've just described?
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe you're right. Maybe this will go to the U.S. Supreme Court, because there's obviously considerable Fourth Amendment issues at stake.
John, you have a background in law enforcement, and you know, these days you're more involved in the investigation aspect. But doesn't it bother you? The subject that we're talking about today hits at the very heart of personal freedoms and the Constitution.
I'm very concerned. I'm a private citizen now, Simon, but and Manny knows, I've always had pretty much libertarian views. And I'm very concerned by it. I would say, talking about law enforcement, I appreciate Peter's kind words about doing the right thing. I think that's true. Like one of my idols, William Parker, said, unfortunately, the police department and sheriff's department have to recruit from the human race. And you're always going to have mistakes made because emotion's going to factor in. You don't know when that deputy or police officer arrives at your house, if he's having a bad day, if he got in an argument with his wife, she's threatening to leave him, his kids are sick, his girlfriend's pressuring him. You just don't know. So when incidents occur, mistakes are going to happen. And that's why I think I would much rather see laws circumscribed as opposed to vague. And I actually agreed with the dissenters of that ruling in Indiana for that reason. And also, you got to remember, too, Simon, a lot of people in my position who are retired and have done their time, we're kind of on the other side now. And I can tell you, there's no dearth of lawsuits in California. There's a lot of starving attorneys. Luckily, Manny's not one of them. He's very successful. But there's a lot of attorneys who won't hesitate to sue a department with deep pockets. And there's a lot of frivolous lawsuits that are just paid off rather than fight it because it would cost more.
Yeah, so John, there's also two factors that people forget. One is the numbers factor. Whether it applies to nuclear bombs in this world or applies to the police, numbers come into play. If you do something long enough, often enough, something goes wrong. If the more police you have, the more likely you are to have this kind of problem. So if you go from a tightly controlled police of, I would say, a 5,000, or let's say a 2,000-member police department in a medium-sized city, to something like Los Angeles, which has, 8,000 or 9,000, and New York,
over 10.
I think they're over 10 now in New York, which has about 18,000. And so
New York has 30,000.
Are they up to 30,000? I haven't looked in a while. So when you look at those numbers, you start to have the numerical effect. How many people can you hire before you get a guy?
Not really, Manny. Look at Bell, California.
Yeah. Look how small it was.
Corruption is everywhere. It matters on the character of the department and the oversight.
You know, that's a very good point. And, you know, as I'm sitting here thinking in defense of the Indianapolis Supreme Court, I mean, if they really feel like they have two alternatives here, one alternative is the rule of law that Simon read earlier today. We hold that citizens do not have the right to use even reasonable force to prevent a police officer from being in their home.
No, get it right. Unlawful entry into their home.
Right. Well, there's either two evils. For all the reasons we've talked about, we'd rather deal with police misconduct than we would deal with giving citizens the right to pick and choose, you know, when they're behaving reasonably or unreasonably, because that just opens up too much of a parade of horrors. And, you talk about the numbers game. If the court is buying into that rationale, they're going to think, well, we have a better chance of minimizing the numbers game on the law enforcement side because we have some control over that than we do on the private citizen side. That's one argument that could be made in defense of the Indianapolis court's decision. If they're really looking at those two alternatives, then it seems to me that's why they pick one. It doesn't do anything to get rid of my concerns, but I understand where they're coming from. They'd rather deal with that problem than the other problem.
No, I understand that completely, but there they're still enabling the police. It's a really, as you point out, it's a no-win situation.
It's a no-win situation.
But
and,
at times we have to err on the side of protecting the Constitution, as someone once said, even if that brings on a result you may not be happy with. And that's what we have here, is
yeah.
we have a breach of the Constitution and a result that many people would not be happy with.
Go ahead. I'm going to go back to Trayvon Martin just for a second. George Zimmerman offs Trayvon Martin, goes about his merry way. The cops decide that he's just fine, you know, he did nothing wrong. There's a huge outcry from the public. So suddenly, special prosecutor steps into the story and declares that Zimmerman, you know, is alleged of second-degree murder. Or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
Right. Now, we have Kenneth Chamberlain. The cops obviously killed him. I mean, we have the videotape, and the cops agree that, yep, we shot him. It goes to a grand jury. And the grand jury says, "Oh no, you guys are fine. Did you were you aware that the case has now gone to the feds?
Of course,
because there's such a, you know, a hue and cry. Sure, it hasn't been all over the press like Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, but." There's been enough stink that, you know, now the government has to do something. And so what's going to happen? Yeah, the feds are going to come in. They're going to go, oh, we need to do something, anything. Let's at least suspend the officers.
I don't agree with Simon. First of all, ever since the 60s and particularly the situation in the movie Mississippi Burning, which mischaracterized it, Viola Luiso murders, that they've been overseeing all of these murders, especially ones in a racial context, under the Civil Rights Act, and they routinely review these because they get so many complaints. And the process of this one came along naturally, although it was supplemented by complaints by the family members, and this is what they do. The problem is people misunderstand grand jury. They think the grand jury is there to really do a thorough examination and make some decision. What the grand jury does is review the evidence presented by the prosecutor, generally in a light most favorable to whatever issue the prosecutor is pursuing, and then render a decision, and they are limited to what is given them. And furthermore, there's the issue that they are not there to decide anything. Basically, the DA can refer something to the prosecutor, and they can charge someone with a crime. Now, when we have an insecure prosecutor who does this Pontius Pilate and says, "Oh, I don't want to deal with this one," he goes to the grand jury because if the grand jury indicts, then he can blame it on the grand jury indicting. After all, the grand jury indicted him. And so there's a certain element of that that is disconcerting because the general public actually believe the grand jury are holding somewhat of a trial or action to make some determination when they're just really listening to the prosecutor. And you may have a more benign description than I do, Peter, but I don't take them very seriously because, to me, they're just an adjunct of the prosecutor's office when they want to do that. Plus, I want to add something technically for those who aren't familiar with it. if the prosecutor receives an indictment from the grand jury, then there's no preliminary hearing, and he has no obligation to put evidence on at a preliminary hearing, similar to what you saw at the bail hearing of Trayvon Martin, where an attorney can fish and have greater disclosure of the case. So it allows them to skip a state and quite one step, excuse me, in the process, and quite frequently that's the reason they do it. And I'm sure, Peter, you probably have a slightly different take on this. So, you know, please show everybody where I am taking a more liberal step and correct me here.
No, I don't think there's much need to correct you. I've always viewed the grand jury as essentially a speed bump for the prosecutor.
Me too.
When the prosecutor really, really wants to prosecute someone. All that a prosecutor is obligated to show in the context of a grand jury request for an indictment is that he has some evidence that indicates the defendant is guilty of the crime. The determination to be made at trial, but the purpose of the grand jury is merely to determine whether or not there is sufficient evidence that a crime has been committed. And so generally speaking, a grand jury indictment is usually just a speed bump. It's really interesting if you get into the question, and Manny, you did allude to this, of what happens when the prosecutor really doesn't want to prosecute. You mentioned a situation where a prosecutor wants to blame it on the grand jury for the indictment, but it also works the other way, in my opinion. Prosecutor can say, well, the grand jury said I didn't have enough evidence for an indictment, so I don't have to indict. And that's a really interesting question to ask when the prosecutor is putting on the case in front of the grand jury and doesn't really want the grand jury to indict. And that's that may be bordering on extreme speculation, but you know that's within the realm of possibility.
And it does happen more often than not.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's speculation. That seems fairly clear here. Yeah, the prosecutor obviously had no interest in prosecuting. You know, grand jury says, oh, okay, now life is good, and they go on their merry way. I mean,
let's explore that. Why would a prosecutor not be crazy about doing this? Well, for one thing, if he pushes a prosecution, he's in effect encouraging a lawsuit against the city, because if he's prosecuted and they're convicted of criminal conduct, then the city is going to have some serious liability problems, right, John?
Well, yeah, you're right, Manny. I hate to agree with you, but that's a consideration. But I'd like to amplify your earlier remarks. I think it comes down to this. High-profile cases make bad case law. I'm reminded of Lenny Bias back in, I think, 87, when he OD'd on crack cocaine, and then for the next month, you see Jesse Jackson, Maxine Waters, and Ron Dellums on TV saying that drug dealers who they blame for his death must receive a minimum 25-year prison sentence. Well, years later, these poor kids are in prison with an ounce of rock cocaine doing 25 years. And it's just an overreaction to these high-profile cases. And look who's suffering. Not now they're saying that law is racist, when they were the ones who advocated it.
Well, John, Maxine Waters is not one of my favorite people in government, but Maxine was
not... Well, there are a lot of people. I just use...
Wait, let me finish that, because I want to correct you on something. Maxine was not appointed to the bench until about 2 years later. I went to a private party for her when she was, gripped my teeth because one of my clients made me go, and I remember when she was...
I'm talking when she was in Congress, Manny. She's
no, this was before. She was a judge. She was a municipal judge in Los Angeles. She was appointed to the bench in, I believe, 1980 or 81, and she was a nondescript, public defender at the time that you're going at. But you can pick on her for other reasons. I certainly do.
Well, I'm just saying it's an overreaction to high-profile cases, and unintended consequences aren't considered at the time. And there always are unintended consequences.
We're back to bad facts make bad law, right, Peter?
Yeah, Very true.
That's
not much we can do. Yeah, not much we can do about it. It is a problem when these cases attract too much attention, and that's just part of the human error element that's involved.
Well, I think Trayvon Martin is a classic example. You could not sit all day and play with a pen and come up with exactly that fact situation, could you? It's just life has a way of creating situations that people do not plan for. And John's right. Not every one of these require a knee-jerk solution or permanently altering the law to compensate for it. And that's your point, right, John?
Eloquently put, Manny.
Well, it's put. I don't know about eloquently. And therein lies one of our problems with all of this is there's this constant need to fix every wrong and right everything and change everything so the next time around the law will be perfect. And we do not live in an atmosphere where that kind of perfection exists.
An important thing to add to that is we also live in a world where people always want to blame something for what happened. They want a clear answer. This was the villain. This was the victim. They want it to be black and white. Unfortunately, more often than not, it's all muddled and it's all a little gray. And sifting through all those various shades of gray is the real tough work of dealing with all of this, but that's what we have to do. And we're seeing it across the board. Every single time we look at one of these cases, you hear facts and they start melding both ways. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult to make things black and white in a world that's mostly gray.
And, Peter, I'm not willing to concede that these people's intentions are noble. I think they're just pandering to the public for their own self-interest.
I think there's a lot of that going on, and that is very unfortunate. But I think as soon as you start putting TV cameras in front of people, it has a way of changing them. Some people just wade right into it without any shame at all, and others try to police themselves and prevent themselves from getting influenced by that, but they can't help it.
I think we've been in Hollywood too long, Peter. We're in a city where I think our politicians and our prosecutors take a media course to make sure they're ready for their moment in the sun.
I agree. I think they travel with their own makeup consultants.
Yeah, so it's getting that bad.
Oh, okay, this is where I really start to, get upset. How big a problem is the press? You know, to me, news is everything. It's good to find out what's going on. I don't want to live in a place like China where, a lot of the news is held back. I want the news, but I don't particularly care for having things rammed down my throat day after day. And when you look at the major news outlets, they all have some kind of axe to grind. Some political, well, it's all political. Fox will hammer for the right.
Here we go with Fox again.
Right, CNN, MSNBC, they'll hammer for the left. But it's not really news. It's more about their perception of what they think their listeners want to hear.
It's not about perception, Simon. It's about ratings. It's about determining who's listening to your show, what they will listen to, and how to get them to basically tune in to you. Because most people don't realize the most profitable show on television is the evening news. And as a result, they spend their entire time trying to curry the favor of listeners because they know that's where the network profits are based. And there's a tremendous amount of pressure, which I listen to quite frequently among my friends in the industry, as to what they put on and whether or not it's going to attract an audience. Not if it's important news, not if it's the right news, but what kind of audience are they going to get?
Okay, but Peter, as an attorney that has worked on some pretty high-profile cases, do you think that the press help or hinder?
I think they do a little bit of both, and I think that it's unavoidable. And, you know, what you talked about earlier is, you know, we want a world, a culture of free speech. And, in fact, our country is premised upon freedom of speech. It's a very important part of a democracy, at least as we envisioned it. But like anything that's powerful, it is prone to abuse. And sometimes they help, sometimes it hinders, and sometimes it just, or many times, it just accurately reports everything that's going on. At the end of the day, what we always come back to is that every institution we have, no matter how we label it or categorize it or glorify it, it's made up of people. And people are fallible, they're prone to weakness, they're prone to being motivated by the wrong things, and it creates a potential for error or whatever you want to call it, a thousandfold. And, you know, what we want is we want our press outlets and our news media to do an accurate job of reporting, but sometimes they can't help but be bent or biased one way or another. We want our judges not to be influenced by this. We want them to apply the law and analyze the facts as honestly as they can, but they're human beings too. Some are more capable of standing up to the allure of the press than others. We want the same thing from our lawyers. We want the same thing from our police officers and our district attorneys. But there's just always room for error and fallibility, and we just have to hope there are enough good people in the system to keep it going in the right direction.
Well, I want to supplement that with two thoughts. Number one, we learned a definition in law school, which is appropriate for the press, that the law is a reflection of the social times. And to a great extent, what we see here is a situation where the social times have changed for lawyers as well as for the press, and the same people who safeguarded the press back in the early days of television, for example, the Morrows, et cetera, had a life grounded in World War II, a different set of values and things. And as a result, their approach to the news was substantially different than what it is today. So the change in the type of people in our world, those who seek more publicity, et cetera, has also impacted the press as much as it has impacted lawyers and other people. John McKay, a famous football coach, once said to me in study hall that, you know, I don't make people into men. He said, playground teachers and their first grade teachers make them into men. And if they haven't made them into men by now, there's nothing I can do about it. And, you know, I kind of laughed at it, but as I got older, I began to realize how correct he was. It's too late by the time to get to a certain level. So here we have a situation where we're not always happy with the morality and ethics of people in our various businesses that safeguard our principles, and yet we're not doing anything to properly educate them and turn them into the types of citizens we'd like them to be. And I think that's a big factor. And back to the economics of the news. If you read anything about the first 15 years of the news, from the mid-40s when TV was launching to the 60s, there's a great quote by David Sarnoff, the head of NBC at the time, and he said it to Murrow once about not paying him because basically, he has the news on because he likes it because it doesn't show any profit and it has no real value to the profit of the network. Now it's completely different. Now that is the principal element, particularly in local stations. Here in Los Angeles, for example, it's very expensive to put on TV stations because they have a much wider area to cover. Just you can't imagine, it's 15 million people between Orange County, L.A. County, throwing the Sacramento County where they have bureaus in each one, as opposed to, even a smaller city, it's like St. Louis or some other area. So the end result is the costs are much higher. So they're much more careful and have more limitations on what they can put on because of the economics. So the combined economics and the facts that Peter outlined so cleverly there, maybe cleverly is the wrong word, Peter, I apologize, are really one of the deciding factors in why our news has deteriorated so much. And John, as a citizen, I'd like to hear John's view of that.
Okay, and before John bends my ear, John wasn't picking on Fox.
You can pick on Fox. He's so hypersensitive. I mean, it would help John if he listened to someone else in the world besides them. I mean, his world is limited to this. And please, I pick on him at lunch every time I see him, and you should too, and I think our listeners should. I like Fox. I listen to him, but I don't base my life on what anything Murdoch might say or do. My God, the guy's the most dishonest man in the world. You know, and you want to listen to his news and rely on it? So, John, I picked on you for the day. So don't be so damn nice to him.
Oh, I don't take it personal. And I never take anything to heart you guys say anyway, so don't worry about it. But I would like to give my perspective, because everybody has their own as they watch the news. And when I was coming up about 30 years ago, liberals controlled the media, Hollywood, the arts, and universities. And I went off to college, and I saw this monolithic thought, and I said to myself, I don't want to be like these people. I'm an independent thinker. And 20 years later, Fox comes along, and they offer an alternative view. And now because they're not monolithic, people are somehow offended by it. And I find it very entertaining, because for the first time, the liberal thought is challenged. And apparently a lot of people aren't secure in their own position to be able to consider an alternate viewpoint. But conservatives always faced alternate viewpoints, because we were always in the minority as far as watching the news or going to a movie, sitting in a poli-sci class. So that kind of stuff doesn't bother me at all, because I'm used to it. And
I don't want to ruin this for you, but you're still in a minority.
I'm very comfortable in there, Manny. Like I tell you, but that causes me to think independently.
Please, someone save us.
Plus, if you want a monolithic media, I mean, like Pravda, you know, Izvestia, and we need alternate viewpoints.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. But I'm not sure.
But everybody hammers because they're different. We should embrace that.
Oh,
Even if you disagree.
I think everyone embraces different viewpoints. I mean,
well, why is it the one station that's different gets the most criticism?
I don't think it gets the most criticism. I think they're all getting criticized. Do you feel any different? Peter, you're on the outside. Do you think there's any network right now that is free of criticism for their content?
I think that the goal of most networks is to be the subject of a great deal of criticism, because that's a sign of popularity, and that's a sign that you're attracting attention. So I don't know which one is more criticized than the next. I do tend to hear more Fox jokes than anything else, but I hear a lot of comments about the LA Times, and I hear a lot of comments about CNN. I feel sorry for the stations and the papers that nobody talks about or cracks jokes about, because I think they're the ones who are really losing out. People are always trying to be out there and on the public name and the public mind.
But, Peter, don't you think a lot of entities have an agenda to promote, and even ratings aren't as big as a concern as promoting your agenda? 90% of people in the media vote Democrat.
That's not true.
I think that there's certainly agendas out there, and I think that at the end of the day, a large media outlet, whether you call it Fox or CNN or whatever you call it, I think at the end of the day, it's primarily run by business people. The content may not be run. You know, I used to work for a newspaper, and we had a business side and we had an editorial side. And on the editorial side, where I was, we thought we were the newspaper. We thought we were the heart and soul. And I realized that, you know, it was the business side that really controlled the paper, and they're about making money. And I think ultimately every successful media or news venture is primarily concerned with making money. And
well, let me
think,
ask you, how many conservatives do you think graduate from the Columbia School of Broadcasting?
I don't know. I don't know if you think the number would be small or large, but I think it's probably, I would guess it's probably about midway. That's my guess.
Yeah. Well, how about this much? How about Stanford and USC, who are notoriously conservative? And so I think that's kind of an odd statement, John. But let's go a step beyond this. One of the things that bothers me about this liberal press position is, and by the way, Nixon advances all the time at a time when everybody from Cronkite and the rest of them were born in small towns in Texas, Iowa, all over the place, North Dakota, South Dakota. Who owns these stations? They're owned by conservative multinational corporations. Look at ABC. I live in Los Angeles. I grew up in the shadow of Walt Disney, knew him personally because my parents knew him. I don't know a more conservative man I've ever met in my life. I don't know anyone, a company that pushes conservative ideals any more than they do. So you can't say that ABC is a liberal station. Then
yeah,
throw in,
it is.
It isn't. And throw in,
because he's been dead almost 50 years.
Well, yeah, but if you take a look at the people who followed him and control it, that's not true. And those of us who had to deal with him, I've had friends who were general counsel for him, and one of them's a judge now in Van Nuys court, and I've known people who were their in-house counsel and run various divisions, and they are anything but a liberal company. And throw in, for example, look at the owners of CBS. Look at the owners of NBC, who are owned by General Electric, who own Universal Studios. Are you going to tell me those people are liberals? No.
Well, isn't Jeff Immelt on Obama's economic forum?
I think they report on it. I've never seen them stand up and go, I support it. You know, where do you get that idea from? Fox is
if
the one
who watch Fox,
political...
you would know that, Manny.
Pardon me? I
maybe if
Fox,
you watch Fox, you would know that.
Yeah, I know, and I would know that Obama was a communist and that he was not born in the United States and all the other things they support. Yeah. But that's not the point. The point is you can't make a broad brush stroke that any one network follows any one philosophy. The only philosophy they follow is found at the bottom line of every major corporation. How much money are we making? And if we're making money, life is good. And I think that's the experience of every lawyer who deals with these people. I'm in negotiations with one of them right now. I don't see anybody in front of me when I'm negotiating, nor will I on Tuesday when I'm there, that sound a little bit conservative, or should say liberal. They are more concerned about taking a more conservative position on every issue to avoid any type of criticism or conflict. Now, that's a form of avoidance, but it's still, nevertheless, not supporting the type of liberal philosophies you're talking about. And let's go back and see how it relates to what we're talking about for a minute here. What we have is a situation where we're talking about issues involving the enforcement of crimes that seem to coincidentally involve minorities on every occasion, okay? And the question is whether there's an unequal application of the law when it involves not only minorities, but poverty in general, because this is a poverty issue, because most law enforcement, particularly late at night, as John points out, because of the time of day, occur in areas where there's poverty. You don't see this happening in Bel Air, which is a Tony area of Los Angeles, where mostly very wealthy Americans, citizens of L.A. live. You don't see this happening in Manhattan, in the upper West Side and all the other expensive neighborhoods there, do you, John? So really, we're talking about a minority issue here, and that application of the law seems to be different, and that's an area that Fox generally does not acknowledge. So I wonder if anyone else has any feelings before I continue to say more than I should on this subject.
I think we should let John rant.
let me rebut that, Manny. I'm more comfortable in South Central L.A. than I am the Upper East Side of Manhattan or San Francisco.
Okay.
So
is
I understand
what
you're
saying.
Is that
because you're afraid you might drop the soap? Is that the problem?
No, those are my people down there. I like them. They're real people. But here's what bothers me. All this comes down to is the skin pigment of the suspect and the victim in all these cases. And it reminds me 20 years ago with apartheid, deplorable political system. And everybody was up in arms. You got to boycott South Africa. Not a peep when atrocities were committed in the Congo, Angola, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Uganda, Nigeria, because both the victim and the suspect were black. Jesse Jackson referred to it as growing pains. Millions of people slaughtered. But because there wasn't that racial element, no one took an interest, or I should say the liberal media. And that's just the way I see it, Manny. It's tragic. To me, every death is a tragedy, regardless of skin color.
Uh-huh. And you're not going to quote Stalin today?
Well, I don't want to burn my material.
Okay.
why is it that, I mean, you see people capitalizing off this, and if by chance any youngsters or hotheads are listening, I would say this. The people that are firing you up and making money off this because of your imprudent actions maybe in the future, when you're sitting in that prison cell, they're not going to be there putting money on your books. And I want everybody to – I wish I could reach these people and give them pause, because they're going to have 20, 25 years to think about their actions, and the other people are laughing all the way to the bank.
Okay, Peter, time for you to wax lyrical.
Well, I think that there is overwhelmingly, if you look at the statistics, overwhelmingly crime is it's a minority issue. Most of the people who are convicted of crimes, accused of crimes, arrested for crimes, fall into certain minority demographics or ethnic demographics. And there are probably a lot of causes for that, including economic, social. I can't even begin to explore that. And, when we start applying the law and we're seeing it being applied disproportionately, that raises a different question. I mean, the question is whether or not it's being applied justifiably, and why. And I can't even begin to get my mind around those issues. But the statistics don't lie, and they're higher in certain demographic groups than others. And that's partly why you see, in my opinion, the incident with Mr. Chamberlain and the incident with Mr. Martin. And other than just observing these facts, I think it would take a lot of study and information to get at everything that's going on beyond it. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of it has to do with just pure economics. And I'm not saying there's anything that can or should be done to fix it, but I think economic issues are certainly fundamental in creating these disproportionate numbers.
Oh, okay. I've heard this saying a thousand times. I don't know how many times I've read it. There's one law for the rich and one law for the poor. And it's certainly the first time I came across the statement, and it had any real bearing on me, was the O.J. Simpson trial. And I bring it up because, Peter, I know you were involved in some of the civil action. But it bothers me that maybe we do have two judicial systems, the one for the haves, one for the have-nots.
I think we always have separation in every aspect of life for the haves and the have-nots. I think that's across the board. And it really comes down to situations by situations. When you look at, for example, the O.J. Simpson situation, I think his wealth had a lot to do with his ability to get an acquittal in that particular case. But I also think that a lot of that had to do with venue, political climate, and the jury, because I don't think that all of his wealth would have helped him if that trial, the criminal trial, had been in Santa Monica.
I don't think anyone would.
Yeah, but I do think that the wealth helped a lot, because I do think that oftentimes systems like prosecutorial agencies that get accustomed to processing the poor and the indigent are really put to the challenge when they encounter a well-heeled, sophisticated defense team. But at the end of the day, I think that result was a little bit more about the venue than anything else. But the overall point you're making is I think there is some truth to it. I just don't think it's as universal as some people may believe. But generally speaking, having money helps almost all the time. But there are many exceptions to it, and it's not unlimited power, in my opinion. When you really run afoul of the law, I think far more often than not, you can't escape it just by throwing a lot of money at it. And there's another example of that I will give you, Phil Spector. And that was also a case I had some familiarity with after the Simpson case. And, you know, all the money in the world wasn't going to change the outcome for Phil Spector.
Well, I've got to jump into the Simpson case. I try not to. John's probably chuckling in the background. But there were several factors involved, and I do believe the most important one was, as you point out, the venue. And I once said, and understand I've had an office in Santa Monica for 25 years. My son's a judge pro tem in Santa Monica as well as practicing there, that I jokingly say, if you can find one African-American man who's been found innocent of a crime in Santa Monica, please let me know. And it brings some guffaws from some of my friends, but none of them have been able to point one out to me to date. And I don't care what O.J. Simpson said in Santa Monica. He would have been found guilty, and that's a sad commentary on the jury pool in Santa Monica and its racial bent. I also find the real mispoint about O.J. Simpson is this, that he's among the few, because I believe there's a case in New Jersey where this happened, where a fairly wealthy person was charged with a crime almost immediately after it occurred, and as a result, he was able to marshal a defense by having his own coroner and other people, similar to what Simpson did, on the job almost immediately after the prosecutor and the coroner's office, while the evidence was still warm, and were able to prepare evidence that is not normally available to the average person. And while people talk about the means of a defendant, and Simpson had a little money, so he had a better defense, understand that a lot of us, and especially myself, did not want a career in criminal law, because I didn't want to be involved in any case in which my opposition could afford to get overworked, public defenders who aren't capable of keeping pace with a highly funded and highly efficient prosecution. Now, that to me is the real crime with all of this, and so Simpson was very fortunate. I, by the way, Peter, had an opportunity to be seated with our then district attorney at a charity event sometime later, and I said to him, why did you really leave that case in Santa Monica? So it seemed to me you were just too lazy to drive to Santa Monica for afternoon court appearances. And he said, oh, I thought it would be so much easier if I could just walk out of my office, you know, over to the interview room and be able to hand all this. And I wanted it was close. We had access to all our employees and all that. And all I could do was just sit there and laugh to myself saying, didn't anybody ever tell you in your office in Santa Monica that you could win the case blindfolded there? But I'm sure somebody did. He just didn't.
Yeah, I think somebody did, and I heard those same things too, that he wanted to be close to the venue for resources, but also for access to the media things. You know, for those who aren't familiar, you know, oftentimes in courtroom proceedings, these things break unexpectedly or there are developments, and then you have these press conferences out on the courthouse steps. you know, to make the trek from downtown L.A. to Santa Monica can sometimes, you know, it's about a 15-mile trip, but sometimes it can take an hour in traffic, and you just can't, logistically, it's impossible to be able to do that regularly. And I heard a lot of reports that he wanted to be closer to where the media was so that he could get out there and be the PR face of the effort.
Yeah. Oh, he admitted it directly to me. He made no bones about it. And he also made no bones about his remorse about it, too.
Well, one thing you can say in his defense, and I don't know what else to say, is that, you know, he's an elected official, and the system wants him to be accountable to the public, and therefore the system wants him to politic and to, you know, try to get reelected. And he clearly tried to do that. I think it backfired a little bit, but that was clearly in his thinking.
Oh, I can tell. But again, that gets back to what makes O.J. Simpson's case really unique is the fact that that was a factor which is not commonly found in other cases of this nature. And I thought it set it him apart even more than the money. Because
yeah.
And so, yes, money was a factor, but, you know, Spector had money. It didn't help him. But in this case, being able to get on the case early, have an ambivalent ground to work on, and, of course, the exposure to the world that we know in Los Angeles, and that is that the LAPD is not what you see in the TV shows, and it's not omnipotent. It does make mistakes, and bad things do happen on their watch from time to time. And believe me, I have the greatest respect for them being raised here, but I also don't view them as omnipotent, while I see other people do. And, John, I'm sure that you think that's important, too. Now that you're a private citizen, I'm sure that your view is that the police aren't omnipotent.
I never thought we were, Manny, but let me just state real quick and think about this. Not everyone can afford the most brilliant legal minds available, such as you and Peter. And attorneys make a lucrative living off this system that is flawed. And
well, yeah,
you guys don't go to law school not to work for rich people. So, I mean, it's kind of biting the hand that feeds you. And let me defend public defenders briefly. Simon, you were saying earlier about them. They're some of the most knowledgeable, experienced, and competent attorneys I've gone up against because they do it every day. They just don't have the time to devote to their cases. But they're not incompetent. A lot of them are very sharp.
I didn't say they were, John. I believe my statement was they were grossly overworked. And
they were... But Simon was talking about public defenders and
no, I was not.
Let me tell the story.
That's kind of like Fox, Simon, but you'll get used to it. And by the way, we're hitting the triple witching hour, and Simon, I guess we'll go over for those people who don't want to see this fight stop. So,
Simon, didn't you get any call-ins today?
They're afraid
no,
to.
I think you chased off all of our listeners.
If you improve your prowess working the switchboard.
That'll never happen.
Well, Rupert Murdoch called and he wanted to thank John.
And Roger Ailes.
Oh, it's tough out there. You know, that is an uncommonly off the mark remark for you, Peter. We're gonna get you loose in your tie pretty quick and join.
Sometimes
this.
I'm actually funny, but you gotta wait for it.
Well, we're gonna get you to lighten up here. But
I gotta lighten up.
Hey, Peter, just picture Simon in his graduation suit.
We're up to two lunches now, Simon.
I'm heading out to L.A. And John, are you in big trouble?
But Simon, we'll have a pint and some kippers.
Do you know how expensive good craft kippers are?
All right, Manny, you did a good job recently.
I mean, they're horrendously expensive.
I'm on expense account.
All right, good. Send me a crate of craft kippers.
And some stones.
You know, when I, you know, John, when I told you you could spend whatever you needed on that case, I did not include kippers for Simon, okay? So anyway, we do have a topic, and back to the topic, this again is about the differences in how money is spent to defend and the minorities and people who have less money, and how differently the law treats them, because we're talking about laws that would not be enforced or happening to people in wealthy neighborhoods. I could not imagine if they shot, well, what if they did that to Rupert Murdoch, okay? I mean, what if they broke into his house like that and basically said, we're coming in anyway? I couldn't imagine what the consequences would be, could you?
I would anticipate a civil suit.
John's right, it wouldn't happen. No one would let it happen.
Yeah.
First of all, I'd like to be working security for him, and I could meet the deputies at the door.
With your submachine gun?
Well, the issue again, John, is he can afford security. Right, John?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course, Manny. There's an equity in the world.
You know, there's one. It's a little bit of a double-edged sword when it comes to wealthy people and their so-called criminal defense. And generally speaking, I agree that you get the more money you have, the better representation you can afford to get. But sometimes it actually boomerangs on you. And I see a lot of instances where people with money who are celebrities get caught in whatever situation they're in, and they end up thinking they can buy their way out of it, and they pay a lot of money. And what they really get is are attorneys who are more interested in promoting their own celebrity and promoting themselves than they are in really doing the best thing for their clients. And it ends up costing their clients dearly. I see a lot of instances where I think the best thing for a lot of these wealthier celebrities to do is precisely what they don't want to hear you tell them to do, and that is settle this, resolve it, take a plea deal, turn yourself in, don't fight this. And a lot of these people think they can fight with money, and they're emboldened by things like the Simpson verdict, which quite frankly, as Manny and I have talked about, is an incredible anomaly in my opinion. And they end up spending more money, fighting more, and then they suffer worse consequences in the end. And I see this quite frequently. That the most recent example I can think of was with Plaxico Burress in New York, which I thought was just a really ill-fated defense strategy. They fought the grand jury indictment, and as we talked about earlier, that's just a speed bump. And it was crazy to fight the grand jury indictment. They were offered a plea deal before the grand jury indictment. They turned it down. Then they went to the grand jury indictment, and then they took a plea deal after they couldn't beat the grand jury indictment, which was insane to even think that they could. And the plea deal got worse, not surprisingly. But the lawyer made money, and the lawyer got a lot of TV time out of that deal. And that was just one example that I could think about. And sometimes the best defense is to just get the best deal you can as quickly as possible.
Yeah, but, you know, I have a lot of experience with that and with wealthy clients of that. And one of the biggest problems you face as a lawyer with them is them accepting that if they lose and they plead, the offer usually includes some amount of jail time. And the minute that word comes up, they just, they just shut off. And it's just virtually impossible for them to cope with what you're saying, because the thought of jail time to them is so scary that they actually cause themselves to spend more time in jail than they would if they would listen in the first place. And that's really, I think, a major factor in that problem.
It's a huge factor, and I like to compare it to the way I thought the defense lawyers handled Michael Vick when he got into trouble.
Right.
Because I thought those guys did an incredibly great job, and they had very little press. They didn't fight anything. They turned Michael in, and they started working on a deal. And lo and behold, Vic's back out, and he's making millions, and his life is back on track. But it is very hard, I can imagine, to try and get these clients to understand that that may be better result for them. Very hard to get past those words, jail time.
Well, and I think the key words are forestalling the inevitable.
Yeah.
That's basically what they're doing, because inevitably they're going to lose and they're going to go to jail, and they're going to go to jail for a longer period of time. And generally what happens to most lawyers I know who say that to a particularly wealthy client, they get fired and replaced by some bombastic guy who guarantees results that he can't deliver.
That's right. That's the really horrible thing about it, and I think it's the same thing that happens with these celebrities and some of their doctors. You know, doctor says, I'm not going to give you that medication. I'll find somebody who will, and they keep going until they do. And that is an unfortunate aspect of all of this, but, you know, what can you do? You can only tell your client what he needs to hear or she needs to hear. If they don't listen, they don't listen.
Well, you know, on a lesser scale, I've seen that occur with even what you would call a regular citizen who won't listen to a doctor, and in some cases go to multiple doctors and get multiple prescriptions for the same drug because the doctor won't give them a dose they want, or for some other reasons are unhappy. So they've learned how to manipulate the system in a way that allows them to essentially get whatever they want. And that, sadly, is becoming more common than uncommon.
Very common.
Yeah. So anyway, we probably should wrap this up. We're having too much fun. When Simon doesn't even mention that, I know he's having too much fun.
Listening to you guys, you know, argue, or I should say discuss.
Argue's the right word.
Right. And John firing shots at me. I mean, what's not to love about the whole thing?
Only in admiration, Simon.
That's right, John. You can buy him lunch in admiration, right, Simon?
That's right. I'm looking forward to my crate of kippers.
So do we get a parting shot?
Sure, go for it. Go ahead, John, lead off.
All right, I'll take this thing full circle, because you were telling me, Manny, I should study up on these cases, and I wanted to spend my time more wisely, so I needed some brain power food, of course, consisting of processed meats and high in sodium. So I went to one of my favorite restaurants. You know, you have to look up at the menu instead of down. And I toasted up to the drive-thru speaker, and I told the guy, supersize me, amigo, because you got to be bilingual in L.A. to order food. So I got my food, and as I was exiting the location, I saw the inveterate transient at the corner, which we all have, and his sign caught my eye because I was stopped at the red light. And by the way, he smelled like he just came from an Occupy rally. And the sign said, kick down the Benjamins or I'll vote for Obama 5 more times. I was so impressed, I gave the guy a fin, potentially offsetting 5 of his votes, $1 per vote. So, Manny, I did that in honor of you guys today. Thanks for motivating me.
The world is clearly a better place.
Okay. Peter, you might...
That up, Simon.
I don't even want to touch it.
I'm glad John lit up with the food metaphor. Because all I keep thinking about since I heard the phrase is kippers and stones, and I think maybe that's what our talk show should be called. I have no idea what they mean, but I like that phrase, kippers and stones.
Scones.
Scones. Oh, I'm sorry. Stones sound better to me because it sounds like we're throwing stones all the time.
Well, you know, Peter, you missed a very important conversation between Simon and I on how to correctly find a steak and kidney pie and make sure that your pastry shell is appropriate. Right, Simon?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I had a long conversation with the one and only real butcher that, you know, has a store here in Picayune yesterday. And I explained my need for kidneys for my steak and kidney pie, and he said, They're just impossible to get.
Wow.
Yeah. It sucks.
Yeah, I'll work on that. Well, maybe I'll put them in a FedEx box and send them to you.
Yeah, I can get them air freighted from England, but yeah, it's a bit price prohibitive.
Is that many more expensive than sending spam to Tibet?
It was not Tibet. It was Outer Mongolia.
Oh, that's right, Outer Mongolia.
Right. No, that was quite reasonable. It was only like $3.
Really?
To me, they ought to have a Kidney of the Month Club or something like that, where they ship them out every month.
Right. You go to Simon, 800.
Are you sure that wasn't yak?
You go to 800, get thin for that, right, Simon?
That's right. And no, it wasn't yak. The deal was, I'd send a can of spam to a guy that really, really likes spam, and spam wasn't available in Outer Mongolia. And in return, he'd send me a can of stewed mutton, which definitely is not available in your local supermarket.
For a good reason.
The spam made it to Mongolia, but we tried like three or four different routes to get that stewed mutton. Couldn't happen. We even tried to sneak it through the Marianas Islands.
Wow.
Nope. Nah, just wasn't happening.
See, guys, this was important to know.
You're right.
So, did you have any final comments now that you're just dying to have something to eat, Peter?
No, I just think, you know, one down, 1,000 to go on our list of solving the world's problems. We're getting there.
Yeah, we are. The only thought I have for our listeners is, as you listen to us and all the wide varieties of different opinions of laws and solving all these, bear in mind that that is the essence of our democracy, is people can have these different opinions, they can have different choices, they can have different ways to solve problems. As we've all seen with the news from China, not everybody does have that, right? Not everybody is able to enjoy the privileges that we have. So instead of arguing constantly with neighbors and assuming you're right, sit back a little bit and enjoy that right to inconsistency. Share views with all your friends. Disagree when you want to. But understand that's the American way, and fight for it and stand behind it, because without it, we're just another third world country. And Simon, you get to sign off for us.
I want to thank all of you for joining us today. It's been fun. And sure, we get off topic, but that's what we're good at. And I'm pretty certain that Barling and Barrett will be back next week at the same time. So I hope you'll join us then. Till next time, Manny Barling, Simon Barrett, wish everyone a happy, safe, and healthy week. Goodbye.
Happy Mother's Day to anyone who doesn't listen to us next week.
Right.